even as the U.S. government pursues a global effort to minimize China's role in the production of semiconductor chips, the scale of China's capacity to produce is proving to be too big. A draw for U.S.-based corporations is moving forward. Is it really possible to ice out China on the global supply chain?
We need a new system. We need a new society. We need to demand that which may have sounded impossible even a few weeks ago, but is not only realizable, but an imperative necessity.
We are very excited to have Professor Richard Wolff join us again for our regular weekly segment, where we talk about the biggest stories related to the economy, the state of the working class, and the crimes of big business. I'm your host, Bryant Becker. The Socialist Program brings you content several days a week, thanks to the support of our patrons at patreon.com/The Socialist Program. We appreciate all of your support and encourage you to become a patron today if you enjoy listening to this show. Richard Wolff is the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work. He's the author of many books, the latest being The Sickness is the System, When Capitalism Fails to Save Us from Pandemics or Itself. Be sure to check out all of his work at rdwolff.com. That's rdwolff.com. Professor Wolff, welcome back.
Thank you, Brian. I'm glad to be here.
Last week, Richard, we mentioned to our audience that the U.S. had demanded that semiconductor chips be produced in the United States at the same time as it was banning the interaction, the economic interaction between various technology companies and Chinese firms and enterprises that relied on semiconductor chips. The U.S. has created this big facility in Arizona, luring foreign companies to set up shop there, especially the companies, the main companies from Taiwan. But there were not enough American workers to actually staff it, not enough trained American workers. And you talked at great length about the inadequacies of the U.S. educational system and the profound impact that has over time on the U.S. economy. Now, here's another part of that same story. CEOs, that would be chief executive officers of the top U.S. chip firms, flocked to China, calling for cooperation and predictability. Well, of course, that message, Richard, is, you know, well received in Beijing, but Beijing is not the one causing an absence of cooperation or the absence of predictability. But the CEOs of some of the leading U.S. semiconductor companies were in China in the last week to attend China's development forum, the CDF in Beijing, expressing their commitment to the Chinese market and willingness to pursue cooperation. So, Richard, here we have it. America is a capitalist country. It has a capitalist ruling class. The capitalists, those who own enterprises, are making a lot of money, have made lots of money, and want to continue to make lots of money from doing business with China. And then there's that kind of smaller part of the ruling class, which manages the affairs of state. And that smaller group in the ruling class, which right now at least has a determining impact on policy, it seems like these two wings of the ruling class may be in conflict with each other. Anyway, it's not a brand new phenomenon, but let's talk about it.
Okay, good. I think you've laid out part of the story really well, the contradiction between neocon foreign policies that have been dominant in this country for quite some time now, and that demonize both Russia and China and try to hold on to the fantasy, in my judgment, of the dominance of the United States. I say fantasy because while the United States was once dominant, got that position as a result of everybody else being wiped out by World War II, and has enjoyed it for most of the last 75 years, over the last 20, that has begun to change. And the bottom line of that change is simply that the United States is being outranked, outcompeted, outmaneuvered, whatever word you like, by the new dynamic centers of world production and world capitalism, because the world is using the capitalist model of employer-employee. The only thing that really varies from one country to another in terms of economics, there are big differences among countries in other ways, but among countries in terms of economics, it's really the balance between private and state employers versus employees, rather than a change in any kind of fundamental organization of production. And the rising power is China and its allies, and the declining power is the United States and its allies. It's already the case, as we've talked about on this program, that the economic footprint, the total output of goods and services, the combined GDPs of the G7, the United States and its allies, is now already significantly less than the combined GDPs of China and its allies in the BRICS. And what you're seeing is the sad, late effort of the United States to reverse history, which is always a very dubious project, to say the least, and very dubious here, too. And the reasons for it are the usual ones. Capitalists know that the profit in the world lies in those places where labor is relatively cheap and the market is growing the fastest. If you're a business person, that's where you want to be. If you're an employer, you want that wonderful combination of relatively low wages and the most rapidly growing market. Well, the answer to that is the BRICS. They have that, exactly that. And American corporations, like corporations everywhere, it's not unique to the United States, they want in on that lucrative arrangement. When you realize that it's not only China, which is the dominant player here, but also India, which is an enormous country and therefore an enormous market, and I'm not even going to bring in Brazil and the others. I mean, you add it up, and any employer who wants to be successful in the years ahead, who wants to be competitively effective, has got to be interested in access to China and its allies. And given that it's China and its allies, while it's nice to be doing stuff in India and Brazil, you do not want, here we go now, to offend the Chinese. It is self-destructive behavior for capitalists anywhere in the world. Now, you might have a few who don't care about China, who are engaged in businesses that have no investment in China and have little prospect of getting a business going in China. Maybe they're already less competitive than the Chinese. Maybe they waited too long to get involved and have now too many people ahead of them doing that kind of business as they do in other parts of the world. These others are doing it already in China. These people might see the Chinese as a competitor to be defeated. And so they would support the neocons in trying to hold back China, which is all that they're doing. And by the way, it's not just in computer chips. It's in many other things. We would already be seeing all over the United States, just to give you one example, electric vehicles made in China because they are the most successful producers of electric vehicles. The quality is better than anybody else, and the price is lower than anybody else. That's a 1-2 punch nobody can defeat. And the only reason we don't see them on our roads is that there's a 27.5% tariff applied to them. That raises the price of every car from China that could come here by 27.5%. So the American people, you and me, are not able to buy what is far and away the best deal in electric cars. Now, will that stop the Chinese and defeat them? Not a chance. And I'll tell you simply why. All over the world, they are not doing what the United States does. So, for example, a company, I'll pick one, in Africa that needs fleets of trucks for whatever work it does, it will buy those trucks sooner or later from the Chinese because they're the best trucks with the lowest fuel usage and or electric, etc. They won't buy from the United States, which means the companies in the United States will see their markets disappear or shrink. That is what the whole process involves. If you're going to play the capitalist game, well, then you have to understand how that game is played, what the rules are. And the rules are capitalists go where the profit is the greatest. If the labor is cheaper and the market is growing, that's where they're going to go. That's why they left New England to go to the Midwest in this country. That's why they left the Midwest and went to the Southwest and the South. That's why the Midwest, which was once the center of our capitalist industrial success, now carries the weird name Rust Belt. Well, capitalism has left New England, then it left the Midwest, and guess what? It left the rest of the United States and went to China and India and Brazil. That's the way this system works. And you might enjoy it when the industries are coming here. That was the 19th and first half of the 20th century. But once the industries continue their journey and leave, ooh, that's the story we're facing now. And slapping tariffs and waging trade wars and demonizing Xi Jinping, these are lame efforts way too late to change a historical process that we're watching unfold despite and over the objections of the neocons who are finding themselves every day way out of whack, you know, way out of rhythm with the way the world is going, which is why the war in Ukraine is being lost, which is why they lost the war in Afghanistan. They have to understand, which they don't want to do, that the world economy has changed, and this struggle over computer chips is just one chapter in that unfolding saga.
Richard, when Marx and Engels wrote the Communist Manifesto in 1848, which was on the eve of a major European-wide revolution against dynastic rule and against oppression and against semi-feudalism, a revolution for, you know, to bring Europe into the modern world to create basic political rights, at least for parts of the population. When they wrote this amazing little pamphlet called the Communist Manifesto, they were young people. They were basically observing what was going on at that time, largely in Europe. But it wasn't only in Europe, because the world market had already existed. Even though the core of capitalist production, of industrial production at that time, was in Europe. And there is this memorable sort of sentence from the Communist Manifesto, and it goes exactly like this. And it's about the ruling bourgeoisie, as they called it. They don't use the language capitalist. They say bourgeoisie. The bourgeoisie is, quote, constantly revolutionizing the instruments and relations of production, and with them, the whole relations of society. So the bourgeoisie plays a revolutionary role. In one sense, they're a counter-revolutionary force when it comes to workers' rights. But at that time, Marx and Engels are saying, well, capitalism revolutionizes the means of production, meaning awakens the productive possibilities or productive potentiality in society from a very sort of slow, slumbering, even glacial pace that may have existed for many centuries prior to that. And suddenly the means of production were exploding. They were revolutionizing them. That was a consequence of competition. The capitalists were competing with each other to gain market share. They had to increase or revolutionize the means of production. And as you point out so well, you know, at one point that sort of the center of the revolutionized means of production were in the eastern part of the United States. Then they went to the Midwest. Anyway, now they're in China. And it's not a consequence of some conspiracy on the part of China. The capitalists went to China because China, quote, opened the door. They had the opening up, the reforms in 1978, 79. They invited Western capitalists to come into their country, and the quid pro quo was something like this. Look, you can come here and you can hire Chinese workers for 1/10 or 1/20 of what you would pay workers in Michigan to build cars. We now have the technological capability to ship those cars back to the United States. You will make lots and lots of money. And we will, one, urbanize our society. People will get wage-paying jobs that, while still lower than Michigan, are much greater than they would if they were peasants in the Chinese countryside. And we will learn how to make cars ourselves. We will adopt these means of production. And what China has done, Richard, is in a planned way, but also taking advantage of Western technologies, they have revolutionized the means of production, and they want to help China overcome underdevelopment and extreme poverty. And the United States acts now as if China put a gun to the head of these American and Western capitalists and demanded that they come. It's just such a misrepresentation of what's actually happened. Go ahead.
Yeah, and that's the beauty of what Marxist theory has to offer if you read it intelligently and understand what they were trying to do. The reality is, to rephrase it slightly, the Chinese offered the American capitalists a deal, just like any other deal. And here is what it was. We have two things you want: low-cost labor and the fastest-growing market in the world, because of our size and because of how successful we have been. You have something we want. You have technology that can save us a lot of time. Instead of reinventing the wheel, learn from you how to make wheels. You have a good technology, and you have a good bit of insight into how to organize industrial production on a mass scale. You've been the leader for the last 50 years in doing that. So you have technology, broadly defined. We have cheap labor and a fastest rising market. We're naturally equipped to make a deal. We'll give you access to our workers, cheap workers. And by the way, not just cheap workers. What China offers is a working class with a very, very high degree of labor discipline. They know how to work in factories and offices. They've been trained for now for 20, 30, 40 years in how to do that. They have a very good educational system compared to other countries at their standard of living. Extraordinary. So you have a cheap working class, but also a disciplined, able, well-trained, well-educated working class. And as I said, the fastest growing market, with no end of that fastest growing market in sight. And so every capitalist, there was not only no gun put to their head, as you put it quite rightly, but there was the opposite. There was an inducement, you know, that was better than anything they had. And that's why they went. They all went. It's this amazing ability here in the United States to demonize Xi Jinping as though this bad man and his evil Communist Party put one over on the United States. None of the CEOs, and by the way, the collection of the major companies in America's CEOs that is sitting right now in Beijing is testimony. They're all over there for one reason. It's not because they like Chinese food or they like to travel. It's because this is the priority for them. And I think what you're going to see play out in the United States, in all likelihood, is a losing effort of the neocons, whether it's those working with Trump or those working with Biden. On this point, it doesn't much matter. They're going to be losing the battle because the underlying big players in the American capitalist system have already decided where their future lies, and they are not going to tolerate the interference, which would cost them a bundle, by political hustlers who can't see beyond the next election or winning this game or that game of politics. So my wager would be, in this struggle between the neocons and the folks who live for demonizing another. American history has been, whether it's demonizing the indigenous people they found here or demonizing the Germans and the Japanese in the first half of the 20th century, or the Russians and now the Chinese these days, there's always this evil other that America has to mobilize against. And that's all fine and good if it doesn't contradict what the major capitalist movement needs and wants. The problem is, right now it does. And in that contradiction, I would not wager on the politicians. I would wager on what the solid, real power in the United States is. And that was and remains the hands of the people who are the major employers in this system.
Richard, I want to turn to another topic. It's off topic, but it's in the news, so I wanted to really get your opinion on it. Last night, very early in the morning, a cargo ship hit the Francis Scott Key Bridge that connects Washington, D.C. area to Baltimore and to the Baltimore port, which is a very big port. And I'm sure our audience has seen these dramatic photos that once it hit one of the center sort of pillars of the bridge, the whole bridge, or almost the whole bridge, collapsed. And number of people died, number of people are missing. Undoubtedly, it's going to take a while to get the bridge back up. The Francis Scott Key Bridge was completed in 1977, so it's not like a 100-year-old bridge. But by bridges standards, it's considered somewhat of an older bridge because there are newer technologies, Richard, that fortify bridges such that if there's an extreme event, a cargo ship hitting it, a major weather event, something really unusual that shakes the foundation of the bridge, it doesn't collapse. Now, there are more than 617,000 bridges in the United States. According to the government's own report, there's something called the Infrastructure Report Card. Currently, 42% of all bridges are at least 50 years old, so the same age as the Francis Scott Key Bridge. And 46,154 bridges, or 7.5% of the nation's entire bridges, are considered structurally deficient, meaning they are in, quote, poor, close quote, condition. 178 million trips are taken across these structurally deficient bridges every day. Every day, 178 million cars are passing over them, or, you know, car trips. A recent estimate for the nation's backlog of bridge repairs shows that there's a need for $125 billion, $125 billion, everyone, to repair all of these 46,000 bridges that are poor, are deficient, structurally deficient. Estimates show that we need to increase spending on bridge rehabilitation, says the government, from $14.4 billion annually to $22.7 billion annually, or by 58% if we want to improve all of the bridges by the year 2071. Richard, they spend $14 billion annually on the 46,000 bridges that are, you know, could collapse. And meanwhile, that's, again, $14.4 billion. The U.S. is going to spend $900 billion on the war machine in the coming fiscal year. Anyway, it's a big issue. It's in the news. I want to get your take. And, of course, the time is running now, but we have a 2 or 3 or 4 minutes, so go for it.
Okay. This is it's a tragic example, of course, but it is also very illuminating to look and see the roots of this. We have a defunct political system. We have two sclerotic old political parties, the GOP and the Democrats, who have developed ways of dealing, or to be more honest, not dealing with our problems, that have kicked the can proverbially down the road to the point where we have events and analyses like you've just nicely summarized. And here's what I mean. led by the Republicans, who have gone to the mass of people and made good electoral victories out of claiming that they have a magic. They're going to cut your taxes. Vote for the Republicans. They will cut your taxes. And you keep repeating it over and over again. Taxes are a burden on people, heaven knows. And so you get large numbers of people to get excited that if they vote for the Republicans, they will have their taxes cut. What they do not do is explain to the people, of course they don't, what that might mean if you cut the taxes. It might mean that you will not have the money to do what needs to be done in this society. But if you're lucky, you'll find something where you can save money by not spending on it, but it won't show up as the disaster it is until you've moved on to higher office and cannot and will not be held accountable. Okay, so here's how this works. You cut taxes. Either the Republicans do it because they won an election on that basis, or the Democrats, fearing that the Republicans will win an election on that basis, copycat them, cut taxes or don't raise taxes. And what do they save on? What are they going to do if they don't raise taxes? Here's a favorite one, infrastructure. Don't maintain the bridge. You should have spent $2 billion this year, but who'll notice if you only spend $1 billion? Yeah, it means you're not keeping them up, but that probably won't mean a collapse of the bridge for years down the road. Meantime, you're no longer the person in charge of infrastructure. You've moved up the political ladder and you hold some higher office. The burden will fall on people come later than you, and that's a really good incentive. Otherwise, you'd have to go to the people and say, wait a minute, I am a politician. I am not going to tell you that I can cut your taxes and it has no consequence for you. I'm not going to do that. Either I'm going to be honest, of course, that's a tiny percentage, or I'll do a little end run. For example, I'll borrow tons of money. That's why our deficits go up. That's why we have a national debt, because the politician has a cheap out. He'll lower your taxes and then go to the rich people whose taxes he's lowered the most and borrow from them the money he didn't tax from them and take care of the bridge that way. But that gets you into the trouble of rising debt. So the Republicans lead the way again. We're going to cut your taxes, but we're against raising the debt. Okay, then what you're going to have to do is cut spending. And you're going to have to do that in a way that minimally endangers your political position. And not spending on slow caretaking of your infrastructure is the easiest, cheapest way to not spend billions of dollars that you could have spent, should have spent. And you will end up, of course, spending much more. Maintenance is always cheaper than replacement, which they will now discover with the Francis Scott Key Bridge. But this is an old story, and it's not a mystery, and it has nothing to do really with the ages of our infrastructure. It has to do with a deficient political system that is constantly saving money in the short run to boost your political posture at the expense of what any fool would know is the wiser way to go. If we want to deal with this, we've got to deal with a political system that may be good at taxing the mass of us instead of the rich, may be good at subsidizing this or that industry, but is undermining the society at least as much. And now that these things are coming to a head, that you get a report card like this, this is a report on what a deficient political system has done to damage the very capitalism it's supposed to protect. And the irony of that is nothing more demonstrably shows a declining empire than this kind of behavior.
Make bridges, not war with China.
Yeah.
Richard Wolff is the co-founder of the organization Democracy at Work. He's the author of many books, the latest being The Sickness is the System. when capitalism fails to save us from pandemics or itself. Be sure to check out all of his work at rdwolff.com. That's rdwolff.com. You're listening to The Socialist Program. We'll be back tomorrow.
You've been listening to The Socialist Program with Brian Becker, where we bring you news and views about the world for those who want to change it. If you enjoyed the show, subscribe on your favorite podcast app and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram, and watch video episodes of our in-depth show, The Real Story, every Wednesday at 7 p.m. Eastern on YouTube with our partner, Breakthrough News. We can only continue our work bringing you high-quality news, analysis, and history with the support of our listeners. Connect with us and become a patron at patreon.com/thesocialistprogram and receive an invitation to participate in an exclusive monthly seminar with Brian Becker.